Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting you ready for the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor with the story of one of the World War II veterans who will be heading back there in this next week. Russ Russell turned 101 in September. He'll travel from his Oregon home to Oahu with the Best Defense Foundation to the spot where his ship, the USS Oklahoma, lost 429 men on December 7, 1941. He now has 80 years of perspective with which to view those historic events. But back then, the prevailing emotion he experienced was anger.
Yes. And back then, everything is Killer Jap, remember? Everything advertising was Killer Jap. Now, it's altogether different. They're the greatest people on earth, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the Japanese people.
But at the time, it's wow.
Well, at the time, you know. But look what happened in Germany. The little community I was from, mostly Germans.
Oh, sure, in Nebraska.
My great-grandfather was German, so.
So you see all these who've been killed, who've been wounded, and then you look out and you see your ship and it's upside down.
Yeah, no home, no place to eat, no clothing, no showers.
Everything you had is on that ship. So what'd you do?
After I left Fort Island, I went over to the receiving station and checked in because I knew they'd reassign us someplace. So we'd look at the every day they post on the bulletin board the names of people where they'd be assigned. So about the third or fourth day, the ship that I went aboard, it was still at sea at the time. So I think on December, I can't remember the dates, but it was quite a while after that the ship came in. And I still didn't have anything to wear. And I had sort of looking for handouts to eat at the receiving station there.
Wow. And you had mentioned you had an uncle on this ship. When did you find out what happened to him?
Well, my uncle from Hickam Field, he and I were visiting there on the receiving station, and pretty soon I saw my uncle walking up from the submarine base, and he had whites on. As soon as I saw him in whites, I knew what had happened. Because, see, they were just covered with oil when they took him out.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the uniform was shorts. And when you have whites on, you know, back when the war started, you knew what happened.
Well, and then he told you what happened to him.
And that's...
Could you believe what he went through? Can you can you share that story with us?
I don't know. If you have claustrophobia, you wouldn't want to hear it. Yeah, the upside down and no lights. Can you imagine? And you're just waiting for that water to build up and the oxygen disappearing.
And this could have happened to you.
It
had
could
you
have.
Not gone up when you went up.
Could have, yes.
So he's trapped in a ship that's turned over and compartments are filling up with water. He's running out of oxygen. How long was he down there?
30 hours.
30 hours. And then they cut him out.
And no lights.
No lights. And plenty of guys around him who are hurt, who are wounded, who are dead.
Yep. Floating around, yep.
What did that do to hear him tell that story to you?
My uncle, it was pretty hard on him. When we got into service action, he sort of went to, he was shell-shocked.
How could you not be going through that?
Yeah. And so they had to discharge him, yeah.
And I don't know if you can give us this perspective or not, but you've been an Oklahoma survivor for 75 years, and you've talked to a lot of other guys who are on your ship. You've got books about it. You know the story as well as anybody. How amazing, how remarkable, how unlikely is it that your uncle and almost another three dozen guys did survive for that long in a capsized ship?
It's hard to believe. And the way they survived was they tapped on the bulkhead to see if there was any water in there or not to find out what compartment they wanted to go into before. As soon as they opened the hatch to go into another compartment, it started filling up too. But that's how they survived from compartment to compartment, yeah.
Can you give us a sense of what you saw? You told us about what you saw at the administration building there when they're bringing the dead and the wounded. But if you looked out at Pearl Harbor, that panoramic view, when this is all over, what did you see there?
You still see what happened those days back then. I can still picture the Oklahoma capsized there and the fire from the Arizona and the ship settled down. You know, and they just settled down in the 40, 45 feet of water, yeah. You know. But it's, I still see it today, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that devastating? What did it feel like?
Oh, my goodness, yes. you wanted to do something, which we did. I'm pretty proud of that ship I was on, that little destroyer. They're little greyhounds, but they sure get around. a lot of high speed.
Well, and we're going to hear that ship's story, too. Were you asked to get involved at all in the cleanup efforts?
No. We had no way of, no clothing to wear. We had nothing.
Well, maybe that's a good thing that you didn't have to take part in that.
That could be, because who wants to clean up that plasma, you know?
And you made the statement earlier that the 429 who died on the Oklahoma, a lot of those guys were your friends.
Yeah, I went through training with some of them, yeah.
Is that something you knew immediately, or was that something that over the days that followed, you'd find out one at a time?
Just one at a time. Just seeing some of the old shipmates, you know, from other ships, or especially destroyers tie up together, you know, and I get to see some of the old shipmates.
So how did you deal with that? I mean, emotionally, to get this news over and over again, that guy's gone, that guy's gone, that guy's gone.
Yeah, I know. It's devastating, but you adjust. It's just everything's adjustment, you know.
We've seen the images from Pearl Harbor. We've seen the poster that was all over America afterwards with the tattered flag and the smoke going past and Remember Pearl Harbor. We've heard the song, yeah. Sammy Kay Orchestra, Remember Pearl Harbor. Can you help us understand, though, how palpable that feeling was in that immediate aftermath of just how motivated you and all those other servicemen were to do something about it?
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a question to ask.
I mean, do I have that right? Is that what it felt like?
Yeah, it's about it, yeah. Devastating, like you said. And I can imagine what my folks were thinking.
Because they didn't know what happened to you.
They didn't know what happened to me. Before I got a letter home, I can't remember when it was, but it's quite a while.
So they're back there in Nebraska, and they hear on the radio probably Pearl Harbor's been bombed, and they know that's where you are.
Yeah, everybody, my mom said everybody, everything was silent back then. Nobody moved. Everybody stayed close to the radio.
And then they may have even gotten the news that the Oklahoma had sunk and still didn't know what happened to you, probably.
They still didn't know, yeah. Right? And then, well, you know darn well, they knew that a lot of people died on those ships. Every ship lost men.
So then they didn't know that you were alive until they got a letter from you.
Until they got my letter,
And how long was that?
It'd have to be when I got on a destroyer, because I never had anything.
So we're talking maybe even a month after it happened? They didn't know?
Probably right close to it, yes.
Yeah, wow. So you get put on a destroyer, which is very different from a battleship.
Oh, the regulations are altogether different. On a battleship, you had to stay in your own division, your cleaning area, during working hours. You didn't go visit anybody, just a community, and you work just like you do on the outside. And then when you wanted to go someplace, you had to get permission to leave the area. You couldn't go down in your compartment. You had to stay in your working area for your 8 hours. Then when I went on a destroyer, everything's more relaxed. We didn't have to wear white shorts. We had dungarees to wear.
And I'm just thinking here. I mean, maybe I should know better, because your birth certificate says you're 96, but you don't look 96.
Well, thank you.
And I'm thinking, it's hard enough for a guy to survive one of his ships sinking, let alone two, let alone the second one sinks on the third anniversary of the first one. I mean, this is kind of a hard-to-believe story you got here, Russ. But
yeah, I think a lot of people, I don't think people believe me sometimes when I tell them. Well, you know, I didn't know it was December the 7th that day when we were sunk. And see what was happening. We had to abandon ship because of the explosions. People were in the water floating around. The kamikazes knocked out our boat. We had two boats that knocked out those boats. Some of the rafts were broken. People were just floating around in their life jackets. And so we went up topside, and we threw everything over it would float. And we had some stages. Those stages we used to paint the side of the ship. So we saved one stage, and we had one wounded man. So we put this wounded man, after we got in the water, we put him on the stage, and he just paddled away. But anyway, there's still three of us left. And I don't know where the other survivors, the current or the tide, just carrying them out. And so here we are, three of us together, and we were going around this Japanese-held island. We were headed out to sea, and I said, oh, my goodness. I thought, sure, the Japanese come and pick us up. They didn't. I think the current was so strong, probably they didn't have a boat to fight it. But anyway, pretty soon there was nothing, no islands out there, nothing but the one we just left. And pretty soon I saw a ship coming over the horizon. I was hoping it was American. It was. It was an American destroyer picked us up.
I want to ask you more about that, but it occurs to me that in those 3 years from December 7th, 1941 to December 7th, 1944, if you're on a destroyer in the Pacific, you saw a whole lot of other things that might stick with you. What were some of the other engagements that you guys were involved in?
We ran into two Japanese ships in 42. We opened fire on them. Of course, they opened fire on us, too. But the first one we hit, I can't remember how many salvos we fired, but anyway, we missed. Just we went over it.
Mm-hmm.
So they fired another five-gun salvo, and we hit the ship, and it exploded like an atomic bomb. There was, when we went over it, it was just nothing. No survivors whatsoever. So there's another one out there. It was a submarine tender. And, you know, tenders are their supply ships and then their machine shops and all
right.
that. And so we opened fire on it. And our projectiles, they explode. Just throws this shrapnel all over the place. We're trying to silence their guns. After we silence their gun, for some reason, they get them back in operation again. Hard to believe what those little Japanese can do, but they kept us going. However, we had to change over to armor-piercing shells to penetrate that seal.
Uh-huh.
Because those projectiles would hit that ship and just explode.
And were you on a gun crew on the Mahan,
yes.
too?
Uh-huh. 5.38, first loader.
Uh-huh. That gets tiring after a while, doesn't it? Picking up those big old shells and over again?
54 pounds.
That's all?
Mm-hmm. But you got to make sure you can't let them wobble around in there because they'd go right up in the air, you know, when they ram it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had to tell you about, we had a few seconds to just relax for a few seconds, you know, just intermittent. I thought, well, I better look around. You know, if you got any time, you look for aircraft. I'm always afraid of aircraft.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking back aft because most of the aircraft always came up behind the stern of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw something go across my face. And I thought, is that a projectile? And I looked in the water. Sure enough, I saw that splash. And then I saw some more splashes. And then that upset me.
How close did they come to you?
You know, they just went over our heads, yeah.
Didn't hit the ship.
Yeah.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yes. You can't believe it.
Did you get used to it? Did you get used to being fired at, to have enemy planes or enemy shells or torpedoes heading your way?
Well, we didn't want to go through it again, but you have to be brave. You can't just let yourself down and hide. You got to just stand out there and get with it. That's what we did. Everybody, it's remarkable what these sailors can do when they have to. Oh, I'll tell you about another battle. This is a good battle we were in. This a moonlight night, four of us destroyers operating off of New Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And we came under, I think they said 63 planes that were attacking us. So we laid a smoke screen. I don't know if I can tell you this story, if it'll go through or not. But we laid a smoke screen, and we were attacked by the Japanese aircraft all night long. And then we finally got fighter protection in the morning, and that's when it ceased. But anyway, we were completely black. And we had quite a few black men aboard ship. And they said, now you're one of us. we had more fun. Those guys had fun with us.
Because of all the smoke screen.
The smoke, yeah.
You guys were just covered in it.
We were covered black, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was pretty good. That was a fun day there, I guess.
And for people, you know, some of our younger listeners especially, they might not realize that the military was still segregated at that point.
Yes,
wasn't integrated
right, yeah.
until after World War II.
But aboard our ship, they were just like us. They loaded those guns. They passed ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a dumb question, but were you scared? Did you ever think, hey, I might not make it through this? I might not make it home to my family?
Many times.
Yeah?
Many times. It's just snap of a finger, you'd be gone. Or,
I mean, I've heard a lot of different answers. Some guys say, no, I was never afraid. I just knew I was going to get there. Another guy said, I can't believe I did.
I was always afraid.
Yeah?
We didn't want to die. Who wants to die, you know, when you think about it?
And you had seen enough that did.
Yeah, right.
Your destroyer was sunk December 7th, 1944, and it was just peppered with kamikazes. And this was before a lot of people even knew what a kamikaze was. I mean, it wasn't until a few months later that they really came in swarms in places like Okinawa and other spots there in the Pacific. Had you ever seen a kamikaze attack before that day?
In 42, we were in this battle of, we lost a carrier that day and a destroyer, and I saw a plane hit a destroyer. I just thought we shot it, or somebody shot it down and hit the destroyer. But I look back now, was it a kamikaze attack then? Makes me wonder.
Maybe. But this wasn't something you guys were really prepared to consider, that they would crash intentionally into your ship.
Well, one time we had this Baka bomber came in. It's just an open pit plane with a big bomb in front of it. And you could hear it flying around out there just above the water trying to hit a ship. And that's when your hair stands up on end. I don't know why. You know, we're so used to planes flying, you know, enemy aircraft coming in. But it's scary. In Japan, Baka means crazy.
Well, and crazy is also one way to describe the coincidence of this sailor surviving two sinkings on the same calendar date 3 years apart. We'll hear about his experiences on the destroyer USS Mahan on December 7th, 1944, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.